You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith. Today, Paul Sinha returns. It's the longest gap we've had from an initial to a returning guest. You'll remember episode 5, I think, was Paul. I've not checked, but I've got a 5 in my head. And to date, the only guest on the podcast to have been interviewed in their car. Paul is not in a car. He's at home now, and it has been a very challenging and exciting 8 years for him. We're going to talk about the mainstreamification of his audience when he went from fringe comedian to celebrity quizzer as the Cineman on The Chase, managing very, very neatly to leverage his passion, his hobby, into something that made him famous and, I would imagine, decently wealthy as well, which is that the dream of every comedian, to do something else? Perhaps it is. We're also going to talk a little bit about how his comedy has changed, how that's changed as a reaction to his audience, the people he plays to, the people that he hangs out with, as he does enjoy having a nice drink with strangers after a gig, and which seems as me a valuable, as valuable a way as any other to source material and opinions. We're going to get stuck into all of that stuff, and then we're also going to talk about how he was diagnosed with Parkinson's just after he had been diagnosed himself. Well, just after he had sort of pretty much diagnosed himself. We're going to get into detail on that and talk about how his comedy has changed from political agitation, or satire at least, to much more personal storytelling. This is a very COVID-unfriendly episode, so with some of them, I will try and point out in the intros for future episodes whether or not I consider them COVID-safe, which is to say, if you are trying to escape, I mean, forgive me for jumping on a meme here, but if you're trying to escape brackets, gestures vaguely and everything, then I will try and make you aware in future episodes of which of them are going to mention the virus and which aren't. This one does. That's all, I think. There is 30 minutes of extra content available to members of the Insiders Club, including Paul on how he refuses to think about mortality, his new style of joke writing on Twitter, and the inside story on his performance on Taskmaster and what was going on in his life at that time. All available at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. But first, here's Paul Sinha. So where do you want to start, Paul? It's been 8 years. This is the longest gap between appearances on the Comedian's Comedian podcast of anybody.
8 years?
It's been 8 years. It was May 2012, and you were guest, I think, number 5.
Oh, that's interesting. So I would have started on The Chase by then. Because I started in September 2011. But I imagine that what you wanted to talk to me about was, how do you make political comedy funny?
It probably was. I think looking back at the show, I think we did.
And now we know the answer, which is you can't. So it's almost impossible to make political comedy funny unless, like Stuart Lee or Mark Thomas, you have a faithful cabal of people that come and see you who broadly agree with your viewpoints and don't take offence when you say things they don't agree with.
That wasn't ever something that you suffered from. Was it? You were great. That was the whole thrust of that interview, was how good you were at making the political personal.
But haven't things changed? I'm a mainstream celebrity now, thanks to The Chase, and therefore the kind of people that come and see me are from a far wider demographic.
I wondered if that would be an issue.
And it's been a very interesting journey as I've become, I was about to say, fewer and fewer political, as an in-joke about grammar patterns, but less and less political, as you kind of have the stuffing a little bit knocked out of you. After Brexit in 2016, there were a load of articles going around about how pro-Remain comedians were struggling in venues full of Brexit-supporting audience members. And I remember reading the articles going, well, of course you're struggling. You're calling them idiots.
Yeah.
Why don't you just concentrate on writing the jokes? Not that they're... I'm not saying it's an easy thing, rather than... But I think that politics has become something where it's just very difficult to deal with. It's a very unfashionable thing to talk about now. And I'm very much aware that when you open your mouth and express an opinion, you just lose fans, regardless of the opinion you're expressing. You will lose fans.
And how important to you is that, given that, like, you are now in the position of being, like, proper mainstream famous, and if anything happens in your life, tabloids, you know, it's a news story. So do you need to retain fans to the extent that you have to do something other than you want to say?
I don't think anyone needs to retain fans. If someone doesn't want to go and watch you do comedy, that's entirely their choice, and it's a choice that needs to be respected. I don't think you should worry too much about whether maintaining or losing fans, just not insulting them.
Yes, okay.
Not calling them twats, I think. Biting the hand that feeds is another way of saying it. It sounds like I'm being very cowardly and say, I mustn't say this or I mustn't say that because so-and-so from Romford might end up not buying tickets for my show in Romford. It's not that. It's just I've gotten weary of the fight.
Yeah.
A little bit. And I've just got other things to talk about, as we know. And so what I've become is gone from being a political comedian to an exceptionally personal storytelling comedian. That's the journey that I've made. And my first tour show that I did after going on The Chase, I had a bit of a break from doing long-form comedy. I did Edinburgh in 2011, and then I started a tour show again in 2013, 2014-ish, mm-hmm. called Paul Sinha is a Stand-Up Comedian. And it was an ironic title because my new fan base, a lot of them didn't know I was a stand-up comedian. In many ways, I suddenly had to go back to the beginning because The Chase has introduced my face to a lot of people that don't know me as a stand-up comedian. So it was a slightly ironic title, but it was an interesting journey because I played in front of a lot of right-wing people. And the reason I did that is because there are a lot of right-wing people.
Sure.
Statistics will suggest that every time you walk on stage, you'll play to a lot of right-wing people. And I learnt a lot about varying the tone. That's one of the things. I think when you're standing on stage for 20 minutes, going wanging on about being gay, which is my description of how a lot of people see me, that's all right because it's 20 minutes. And it's also very joke-intensive. But over 60, 70, 90 minutes, the joke starts wearing thin quite quickly, especially for... I'm reminded of my ex-boyfriend who overheard someone say at the end of a gig in Surrey, I'm glad I didn't bring my wife. She hates fudge packers as well.
Oh, my God.
And I'm reminded of the time that about eight people in Rotherham just walked out within 3 or 4 minutes of me saying that I was gay. And I'm like, this isn't my fault. I've been very open. You're the ones that have not done the reading.
Do you feel that your previous existence as a stand-up comedian at festivals with audiences full of lefty festival goers and Radio 4 fans, do you think it kind of insulated you from that reality?
I don't think I've ever been insulated because I'm a club comic. You know, I've stood in the coalface, banging out very apolitical jokes about bumming and cocksucking. sometimes the other way around, because I'm versatile, and I know what it's like at the coalface. I don't feel I've ever been one of these insulated comedians. No, the other thing is I do a fair amount of corporate work, and it's not an easy subject to talk about. But because you don't, A, you don't want to boast about money, and B, you don't want to look like you sold out. A lot of the gigs are great. A lot of corporate gigs are really good. And I put my hand on heart and say, there are gigs that have enriched my soul.
Mm.
Because the ones I really, really like are ones supporting industry. Retail, you know, rewarding the best this and the best that and the best this and the best that. Best shoe shop in Cardiff, best shoe shop in Coventry, whatever. Rewarding people who work hard for a living.
Mm-hmm.
I actually really like those.
That is a lovely way of thinking about it, actually. I've done some of those sorts of, you know, awards ceremonies for people who do a real thing. And
yeah.
And that is, you're right, that is satisfying. It is different.
And what happens then is you drink afterwards. If you had a good one, your neediness for a company and people going, you're really funny today. There's nothing better than people saying, you were really funny today. Well done, well done. So your need for that approval means you stay for a couple of drinks and you start drinking with the Tories and you hear their point of view. And although you can't be bothered to go, I disagree with every word that you say, at least you're hearing their point of view and you're listening and you know what it is. So when Brexit came along, I wasn't surprised. I wasn't surprised at all. I had a feeling from the corporate gigs that I was doing that that was the way the wind was blowing. And I had a feeling that proved to be true that the kind of people who felt strongly enough about it to vote were likely to vote let's get out than let's stay in. So I don't consider myself an insulated comic at all. I'm somebody... Well, I warned you that I'm going to talk for Britain, so the conversation will ramble in many directions.
That's absolutely fine.
But one of the side effects of being a minor television celebrity is that I really like to get drunk with strangers after gigs. And that's when you hear what the world and his wife are thinking and talking about.
Yes.
And so while other people are going, oh, they booed me just for... All I said was, anyone who votes for Brexit is a retard who needs to be killed. That's all I said. And for some reason, they started booing me. And I just don't understand what I'd said wrong. You get that sort of... I've never been that sort of... You have a joke. If you're going to do... I think I said... I've listened to our interview last time. And what I said to you was, the trick with political comedy is have a joke and have a political opinion, but don't always make it at the same time.
Yes.
I've changed that now to have a joke. if you've got a joke that makes people laugh, they suddenly forget that they don't necessarily agree with the sentiment of the joke.
Okay.
So, I give you an example. I don't think I had this joke. I may have just started doing this joke. But the boyfriend I had when we last did this was very, very Tory, very right-wing. And I had the joke, the sex is amazing, he likes to pretend he's the late Margaret Thatcher, and that I'm the British manufacturing industry in the 1980s. That's a joke that survived the most Tory of audiences, because it's a joke.
Yeah.
It's a strong joke. And let's be honest, if you voted Tory, you did so because they destroyed the manufacturing industry in the 1980s, and it gave you a bit of a hard-on. So if you write a joke that's funny enough, it doesn't really matter. But writing routines is a lot harder if you're expressing opinions that an audience don't agree with. So this is a very long way of saying, I've become a storytelling personal comedian.
And that's,
since we last met.
And that isn't... I mean, one of the things that was so successful about your, inverted commas, political stuff was that it was all embedded in your life. So it's not too much of a leap to excise some of the trickier asks and just do the story stuff.
No, that's true. But what's changed is my life.
Yes, well, you're not short of material, given...
When we last met, I was dipping my toes in the world of minor celebrity. Now it's my life. It's one of the two things where the funniest things occur from. The dissonance between my relative discomfort of being a minor celebrity and the reality of being a minor celebrity, and secondly, I can't remember what I was about to say there. Secondly, some really, really clever concept that I just cannot remember what it was going to say. But also, you knew me when we started as the man who'd always been single.
Yes.
Suddenly, I've got relationships to talk about.
Yeah.
And it's really funny because it's me who's never had a relationship talking about being in a relationship. And obviously, it's a cartoonish, out of respect for the people I go out with, it's a cartoonish version of what being in a relationship is. But I've had that string to my bow for the first time in my life. Yeah, go on.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, there is so much that's happened in your life since we last spoke. That's happened in the world and happened in your life. And so I listened to a hazy little thing called Love. Was that your last tour show or was it, I listened to a preview. I don't know what state that is, whether you have toured that yet or whether that's something that's been put on hold.
Is this the one about everything in the last 18 months?
It's Ollie, The Proposal, all of that.
Yes, that is... It, I see it as a superhero with a nemesis called COVID-19.
Yeah, okay.
it's the show that was cruelly yanked from the schedules.
Yes.
In the middle of March this year. I played Peterborough in March, and we looked at each other, me and the audience, and we knew this was going to be it for the next. The lockdown was on its way. It was a very bittersweet experience in the sense that. It was a really good gig, and yet I knew, even though I had 3 gigs booked in the following week, that they were all going to disappear from my schedules. And lo and behold, they all disappeared from my schedules. So I've not done the show since March.
Do you have what I sort of recognise as the, given that your former life as a GP, anyone I know who works or has worked in medicine seems to have that kind of insider information on what they expect from COVID, what they expect from the recovery time from a pandemic. I feel like most of the chats I have with my friends are, you know, they're along the lines of my sister, who's a nurse, says XYZ or predicted XYZ about what we can expect.
Well, it's funny. I mean, it's funny you say that because that is essentially the last 2 weeks of March for me.
Yeah.
So I did Peterborough on a Thursday, I believe. And then 2 days later, a friend of mine called Amy, who's a respiratory physician at St. Thomas's Hospital, sent me a message on Facebook going, make sure everyone you love is safe. Which is quite an apocalyptic message.
Yeah.
When you're expecting, are you watching Match of the Day? That goal by, that's the kind of message you're expecting on Saturday. And it was, make sure everyone you love is safe. And it was at that point that I realised that my 3 tour gigs that week were not going to happen.
Yeah.
And then they followed what I can only describe as a bizarre chain of events where, on impulse, given that I've got a sister with her husband and 2 small kids who live less than a mile from me, and I've got a mum and a dad, my dad had just come back from a heart operation, who live less than a mile from me, me and Ollie decided, I decided, and Ollie tagged along, that we wouldn't isolate in our small, rather cramped flat in South London, and stayed in this place on the outskirts of London, the Surrey-London borders,
okay,
called Byfleet. I didn't know how long I was going to stay. Turned out 3 months. Who knew? But on that, we left on the Thursday, which I think was the 18th, and then on the 20th, I woke up with what was clearly COVID. I could never be more grateful to the fact that I had a WhatsApp group full of consultant physicians who were able to guide me as to what to do on a day-to-day basis. I was never short of the best clinical help over the phone. But I woke up on the Saturday afternoon after 12-hour sleep, went down, had some lunch, fell asleep, woke up about 12 hours later. And I thought, well, that's never happened to me in my life. Mm-hmm. And what's more, I've got a dry cough. I've got a swirling fever. I feel absolutely awful. I feel absolutely exhausted, despite having had 24 hours sleep in the last... I knew what was going on. I don't know where's the right place to say this. This is a comedy podcast, but... in the middle of the week, one of my friends died of COVID-19. I tweeted my despair. The next thing I knew, tabloid newspapers were harassing my agent to ask her whether I was going to say anything else about my friend that died of COVID-19. The answer clearly, no. At this point, I realised that I was the reason that the family of a friend of mine were seeing their loved one's photo in the tabloid newspapers. And you can imagine how well that made me feel. Mm. I was constantly having to crush the urge to fight the tabloids. My friends going, stay in bed. Don't fight them. Use your energies for something else. And then 7 days after the Saturday that I woke up, I couldn't breathe. I couldn't walk to the bathroom without being very short of breath. Almost psychically, my respiratory consultant friend rang me up and said, you need to go to the hospital. I rang up the NHS. They said, we'll ring you back in the next six hours. Mm-hmm. And when they did ring me back, my incompetent fat fingers completely failed to answer my mobile phone. And when I tried to ring the number back, it wouldn't answer because it wasn't that sort of phone number. It was one way only. And I thought to myself, well, I'm done for. And I walked to the bathroom in the afternoon and I suddenly realised I've just walked to the bathroom. I couldn't do that this morning. I've just walked to the bathroom. And that's when it occurred to me that as simultaneously that I missed the phone call, my body had started to fight back. So it all happened on the same Saturday. And I can't remember whether you saw my post on Facebook, but at this point, my consultant friend rang me up and said, oh, I said, have you noticed I can actually speak to you? And he just very blithely said, all right, yeah, day eight, the recovery. You're going to be all right.
Jesus.
What he didn't say was, it's going to take quite a long time, but you're going to be all right.
Yeah.
And I went onto Facebook and said, I've just been told I'm going to be all right. And then was really, really ill for the next 7 days as well, wondering where is this recovery coming from. He was right. That morning, if you plot the graph of where I was the worst day. And ever since then, I've been in fight back. And clearly, from his words, they see a lot of people who start recovering 8 days in.
Mm.
But it strikes me as being unbelievable that if I was more competent at answering my phone, I'd have been in hospital and not recovering. Mm. So that's the way it is. I had a very, very straight. And it's my job one day to make it funny. Because that's what you're constantly thinking as you're lying in bed with illness. Comedy, tragedy, time. And that's the kind of stuff that I do now, is try and make comedy, tragedy plus time. And so one day I'll make it funny. But I had the most extraordinary March the 20th.
Let's just stay with that for a second, because to what extent, at that moment of thinking I'm done for, what sorts of things were you thinking about your life? Like you, I mean, we know that you were diagnosed a few years ago with Parkinson's. I've got no idea about the long-term prognosis of that or your personal expectations of the rest of your life. Like, what kind of relationship have you got with mortality at the moment?
None at all, because I don't think about mortality. I really don't. I was diagnosed with Parkinson's last year, and as far as I'm concerned, I've just got to enjoy what I've got while I've got it. I don't know when this is all going to start kicking off. I mean, apart from the fact that my medication makes me tired fairly regularly, I'm functioning well.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that my creative output... it's interesting. I'd say that my creative output has increased enormously. But I think the main reason for that is I didn't know I was unwell for a couple of years. And so I didn't realise that my creative output was a bit subpar in a couple of years before that. I say subpar. My 2017 show, which was called Shout Out to My Ex, and the show was about the weird 2 years after the week after the Edinburgh Festival of 2015, my ex announced that he was breaking off the relationship because he wanted to live life as a heterosexual man. There then follows a series of incidents and accidents over the next 2 years that ends with me now finding a new boyfriend. And it was the best realised show that I'd ever taken to the Edinburgh Festival. And it was great to take a show that you knew was really, really good. And, you know, it was a great advert for having a fallow year between Edinburgh's as well. Mm-hmm. Because I'd gone out in 2015 and then taken a year out. And it was great. And in September that month, I woke up with a frozen shoulder. And I've never had any orthopaedic problems before. And everybody thought it's just an orthopaedic problem. And so with the assumption that it was an orthopaedic problem, I just carried on life, just with a frozen shoulder. Then in 2018, I was invited. My first investigations for frozen shoulder in 2018, they found out as a sideline that I had probably had diabetes. Mm. And at the same time as that, I ended up on a fast-fix diabetes reality show that I was invited to before I found out that I had diabetes. That got rid of the diabetes, but the shoulder never got any better. And then we come to 2018 and taking a show about health. Mm-hmm. Why not? Mm-hmm. Turn what's happened to you in the last year into a show. And as I said, I found that I was really tired at the Edinburgh Festival. Tired of the fight, in the fact that I had a spat at the beginning of the run with Kate Copstick,
okay,
who had written a particularly ignorant article where she basically was taking revenge for the fact that I said I don't want any reviewers in on the first preview night. Mm-hmm. And she said, well, this show can't be ready then, ignoring the fact that I got a standing ovation from 280 people at South Shields for the Sunday of that particular week. She decided that my show can't be ready because she wouldn't be let into my preview. The reason I don't want reviewers in the preview is you're getting used to the room, the technical aspect, the techie, the sound cues, the space, the lighting. You got all of these things that you're just running through in your head. That means a review is the last thing I want on the first show. After that, it's a free-for-all. Anyone can come. So it was a weird curate's egg of Edinburgh in 2018. It was a good show, but it wasn't as good as the previous year. And some drunk friends were only too keen to tell me, we enjoyed the show, but we didn't think it was as good as last year's show. And we're like, no need for that, thanks. In March last year, I finished touring the show with a run at the Soho Theatre. And lots of my medical school friends came, and none of them saw anything odd about the way that I was shuffling across stage and generally feeling a bit limited in my movement. Dominic Maxwell of the Times criticises the quality of my physical movement when reviewing me at the Leicester Square Theatre. I hope he's feeling suitably chastened. And then everything starts sort of unravelling in New Zealand last year. So I know you're a big fan of New Zealand.
Cute, love it.
I did my first New Zealand Comedy Festival last year, and it was a joy. I mean, it was like nothing. You won't know this, but I've never done an overseas comedy festival, ever.
I didn't know that. Why was that?
When I was Flavour of the Month, which is 2006, 2007, 2008, Chappie and Stephen K. Amos were coming through at the same time, and I think they just had their fill of they had their fill of literate ethnic. You laugh. I think that's probably why it was.
God.
But also, there's never been a universality about my material. My material has been quite British.
That's true.
And so I wonder whether that had a... But I never got asked.
Okay.
Never done Melbourne. And I remained resolutely off the radar in New Zealand until The Chase becomes the most popular TV show, pretty much, in New Zealand.
Okay.
I don't know why. I have no idea why it's hit the right button. But But my word, we're proper A-list.
What,
in New Zealand.
What an idyllic experience. I always think this, with particularly with comics, when you have fame that is not centered around your comedy, to be able to turn up and be a super famous guy and then have the comic chops of a 20-year career must be...
Oh, well, it was, that was very much the dream, because I was able to do a greatest hits show that was mostly based on the last 2 years. Oliver was treated like a king. I was treated like a king. And you may or may not be unaware of the humorous side effect, which was the increasing frustration of Mr. Alistair Barry.
I wasn't aware of that.
He suffered what I only described as the funniest humiliation of all time, when he wrote a really, really good and thorough food blog. You know, he does a food blog.
Okay. I think I did know.
So he was reviewing restaurants in the New Zealand area. And often me and Ollie would be with him, enjoying the food with him, and we'd get name checked in the blog. And then one day a New Zealand newspaper had a report that was headlined, "Cineman from the Chase massively enjoying New Zealand food." And it was all just a report on Al's blog where he didn't get in the headline for the story.
Oh, heartbreaking.
And there was also the time that I tweeted something about an ultra-right-wing, homophobic New Zealand political figure called Brian Tamaki. And that made the news. And the way I found that it made the news is I was sitting in a van taking us from the airport back to Auckland when it came up on the screen in the van. The Chase's Cineman takes swipe at Brian Tamaki.
Wow.
That was one of the oddest things.
I was worried that story was going to end with the way I found out I was in a van and another van came and cut us off and ran us off the road.
Well, I got a lot of free food, a lot of attention. It was great. It was wonderful. But it was quite clear that my health was deteriorating.
Yeah.
And there were some really hard nights of the soul towards the end, because I'm always been a selfie person. I've always been I will stay and I'll reward everyone that's come to the show with a selfie. And I was exhausted by the end of the run, and my shoulder was really, really tight, and I could barely move, and I was just exhausted, and I knew something was up. And to be honest with you, when I say I knew something was up, I knew it was Parkinson's. I knew. Yeah. I'd done the reading. I'd worked out that everything I'd had was actually quite typical for Parkinson's.
So those symptoms were a reduction in your movement capacity, tightness in your body, exhaustion.
Limp.
And is there a mental component besides the exhaustion?
I think it's different for everyone. I wouldn't want to make any sweeping statements on that. I think from a mental point of view, it's different for everyone. But I had the whole thing then of coming back and knowing that I needed to find out straight away, because I had a run booked in Edinburgh. And so I found out that week, end of May, when I paid to go and see a private consultant as soon as possible, because I had to have a decision as soon as possible. He said, "You've got Parkinson's." And I said, "Next year's Edinburgh, it's going to be amazing." Finally, I've got the pathos that I've been looking for all this time. Obviously, I was devastated. That goes without saying. But the first 2 weeks, far worse than anything else. Going through your relatives, going through your friends, going through the sheer broken-hearted misery of your mum and dad, who are looking at you just going, "What can we do?" And seem in disbelief that the answer is simply nothing. And that's when the next stage in my career starts. Because after the initial shock and had worn off, I thought to myself, right, I'm not doing Edinburgh this year. I'm bloody well doing Edinburgh next year. I didn't know that the Chinese virus was going to have a say in all of this. And it was my idea to write a big, big show. Also, in August or September, I can't remember, I did a gig with Vicky Stone.
Mm-hmm.
and I saw her on stage, and I thought to myself, fuck this, I'm going to start doing some songs as well.
Okay.
And the key thing is, because I can,
uh-huh.
because now I don't give a shit, fundamentally.
Okay.
I said that. That's the big thing that's changed.
So talk to me, just to hover on that for a second. You might have done songs previously, but felt too inhibited. Is that what I should infer from that?
I can't sing. I mean, I really, really can't sing. So I've created, I should not say created a narrative. I've created a narrative of the song that explains why I'm playing the piano, even though I can't sing.
Gotcha.
It's actually based on the truth, which is that one of the New Zealand comics runs a piano bar in North Auckland, and he'd heard a rumour that I could play the piano from Lloyd Langford. Well, when Lloyd Langford saw me play the piano, I was pissed off my face. It was the last night of Edinburgh in 2004, and I was a very, very different human being to the one I am now. I turned up to the bar out of politeness and couldn't play the piano at all. And so for me, playing the piano is a symbol of the fight back.
Okay.
It's a symbol of me going, right, Parkinson's is stopping me from playing the piano. No, it bloody well isn't.
Okay.
And so I've become a musical comedian. I have a song at the beginning and the end of my show. And in my opinion, they're both good. Not in everyone's opinion. but the point is, it doesn't matter. The point is, I'm doing it because I can. And this is all part of a show that I've written that I'm really, really proud of, that has got massive numbers of surprises at every juncture.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the one thing that I can promise you about the show, is it's full of, oh my bloody God, because I now look back on my last few years and it all suddenly pieces together. And also, this is my chance to tell you, everybody, what's happened to me in the last 4 years. And it's with big jokes. If you think there are... You've seen half the show.
I've seen half the show. I'm looking forward to the second half of it, yeah.
There are some real, real things that are going to take you aback in the second half.
Okay.
And I'm really, really proud of it. And that's why at the moment, I know that you shouldn't moan because other people are worse off. But the fact that I've been removed from the touring comedy circuit by this pandemic is of a massive frustration to me. And the show is me slightly unleashed.
Okay.
And that's what's changed. What has changed is I don't feel any fear. I feel that these have got to be the years where I say the stuff that I've always wanted to say on stage, or be the comedian that I've always aspire to be the comedian that I've always wanted to be on stage, which is wrong-footing and brutally honest.
This is Paul once again, a joy to have him back. And I think because Paul was one of those people who was a headliner when I was a new squit and someone who I drove to gigs. We shared an agent at that time, and I would frequently be subbed in, I guess, as a sort of MC or middle act in order that I could drive him to shows. And I've had the pleasure of his company as a result on numerous occasions. And I very much enjoy spending time with him, and also the very measured and considered way that he thinks. He's a big thinker. It's not an over-exaggeration to say that he knows almost everything. It is clearly an over-exaggeration, but my point is, he knows lots of stuff. And you're listening to someone who earlier on had to submit 3 to 5 books that really affected my life for Lucy Dancer's excellent podcast, which I shall be on in the near future. And it really stumped me. obviously I have read books. I just don't access my memory in that way. And by the time I'd written down an example of a Stephen King book I've read everything by Stephen King, and an example of a Terry Pratchett book I've enjoyed, I've read everything by Terry Pratchett. It was only then that I thought, oh Christ, I better finish Sapiens, so that I've got something to say. So a joy to spend time with Paul and his brain and his wit, and we are going to continue this episode in just a moment. A reminder, comedianscomedian.com/insiders to find out all about the behind-the-scenes story of how he went down on Taskmaster and his new style of joke writing on Twitter, which is very exciting because it contains a kind of cryptic or sort of quiz element. So look forward to that if you're in the Insiders Club, or join it if you're not. Couple of other things. The strand that I've been doing, you will know. Will you know? Who knows anything? I regularly tell everybody what I'm doing via social media and then do it once and then don't mention it again because it sort of clashes with my values as a human. So like, you can't be self-deprecating if you're constantly advertising things. That's a big clash, he said to people listening to someone unafraid to mention other stuff he's up to. God, this is florid. My point is, I'm on Twitch, right? I've been trying not to say the word Twitch because it scares people off. But if you go to twitch.tv, that's it, as I always misspell, twitch.tv/Stu Goldsmith, you can find out everything I'm up to on Twitch. And if you're scared of Twitch, then you can just go to infinitesofa.com and it lets you watch it without needing to go to the website. It's just live YouTube, really. And it contains, on Monday nights, we do The Infinite Sofa. You've heard me talk about that a lot. Paul was excellent on that, a recent appearance. And if you do go to Twitch, or indeed the YouTube channel, youtube.com/comcompod, you can catch up with previous episodes of The Infinite Sofa there. Tuesday nights, we do Chops Comedy, and we've got some wonderful acts coming up on that, including Maria Bamford, who enjoyed her slot on The Infinite Sofa so much, she's going to come back and do a short set of new stuff on Chops. And on Wednesdays, we do a thing called Think Tank, only Think Tank is a sort of a strand, if you like. It's a Wednesday nights, we do fun experiments in the world of comedy and community and creativity and the internet, and just sort of seeing what you can achieve when you get a bunch of idiots in a room together and they're all connected to the internet at once and I'm in charge of them. Or I say in charge, cat herding at least. So the strand is Wednesday nights, it's called Think Tank. Last week we did a new thing which worked so well we've given it a proper name. It's called Hive Mind Heaven, in which myself and whoever turns up into the Zoom room on the night have 75 minutes to create the perfect experience for a surprise celebrity guest who joins us at 9:15. Show starts at 8, and at 8 o'clock I reveal the guest and their five favourite things, pre-conversed about, predetermined by me. In conversation with them, I drop those five things on the team like a bomb, and we all go about scrabbling to create some sort of mind heist. Laura Lext was our guest last week, and it was sumptuous, and you can see that in the videos section of the Twitch channel as well. So basically, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, there's always something fun and interesting happening in the evening at either 8 or 9 o'clock at twitch.tv/Stu Goldsmith. But do go to infinitesofa.com if you find any of that frightening. Okay, that's all of that. Let's get back to this episode with Paul Sinner.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
What's the relationship between that new lack of inhibition and your mainstream audience and the fact that you don't want to?
Well, it's interesting because somebody at Southport, not that I have a vendetta against anybody that's ever been
I love the way negative. You identify specific towns. A Romford audience, someone at Southport.
Somebody at Southport at a gig that was quite frankly massively enjoyable at every level. Somebody at Southport said, I was very disappointed. All he did was talk about his family and his illness and being gay. And I'm like, what the hell did you think I was going to be talking about in a show called A Hazy Little Thing Called Love if it wasn't my relationships, my family and my illness? I mean, what on earth was she expecting? Yes, it's a show about family, relationships and illness. Do you know why? That's my life. That has been my life for the last... What on earth do you think? Did you think I was going to recite pi to 300? I mean, I just don't understand. And that's part of this. And it's not like I don't give them stuff about the chase either. I do. I always have done. It's part of my life. I've always had comedic anecdotes. For me, there should be something for everyone. But this is a show that really lays it out there. And, of course, there's more to come because the show is partly about how I got married. and I've not really done material yet about my wedding day. I've got jokes about my wedding day, but not material about my wedding day, by which I mean, what was it actually like?
What I found listening to the part of the preview that I listened to was that your, and this is part of the curse of me doing the podcast, is as soon as I've had someone on the show, I can no longer prioritise catching them at Edinburgh, so I'm a bit behind on your oeuvre, right? So I've seen like six of your shows or five of your shows years ago, and then I'm like, there's been a big gap. So I haven't seen much of you in the new, you know, persona, the new audience, that kind of thing.
I mean, in summary, 2015 was called Postcards from the Z-List, and it was amusing anecdotes about how I became a Z-List celebrity. 2017 was Shout Out to My Ex, the action-packed 2 years since I got dumped. 2018 was the health one.
Yep.
And then 2019, I had to cancel Edinburgh. And then 2020 was meant to be this one.
Yes. But what I really perceive as like the big difference is the, because your audience, there's some difference in tone, because your audience now, it reminded me of not being a quizzer myself or being part of that community, but knowing that people who are fans of daytime TV are coming to see you, but not simply fans of daytime TV, fans of daytime TV who have a bent, you know, who are leaning towards quiz fans, a particular type of people. It struck me that tonally it had something in common with a Doctor Who convention. Do you know what I mean? That there's something, yeah, there's some sort of tone whereby we all have a shared interest, and it's like you're almost part of your job is to facilitate their fandom.
And I used to do it literally, by which I mean I used to have a Q&A at the end.
Okay.
And the purpose of the Q&A was, there are many of you today who have watched me and thought, this has been shit. For you lovely people, you get an opportunity to ask me a question about Bradley Walsh. And so they put their hand up and they say, what's Bradley Walsh like? Or they say, who do you think's the best chaser? Or they say, who makes the offers? Etc, etc, etc. And at least they've gone home with something.
And do you...
For those, it's,
go on, yeah. Go on, sorry.
And for those people whose idea of hell is to watch an openly gay Asian former doctor turned comedian talk about his life for an hour and a half, at least they got their question answered about Bradley. And I would say that the questions were 88% the chase and 12% all other things.
Do you, and you might find this impossible to answer honestly, do you respect those people who are there for that reason as much as a comedy
The only
fan?
People I don't, the only people I don't respect are people that turn up and go, this wasn't what I was expecting at all, and I don't like it. Because there's enough blurb about every show by the time the show goes on tour, there are reviews all through. I think it's important as a consumer that you do a little bit of research into what product you're attempting to buy before you decide whether to buy it. So if someone says to me, you weren't what I was expecting, didn't enjoy it, I'd just go, well, that's your fucking mistake then, isn't it? You know, it's not for me. I didn't come into your house and go, do you want to hear some stories about the chase? you have the responsibility to make your own decisions.
Is there, is there, in terms of your lack of inhibition, was Paul Sinha, the comedian 15 years ago, similarly uninhibited?
Well, my signature show that you definitely saw, Saint or Sinha, put me on the map because it was uninhibited, I feel. Mm. Because it was something of a surprise, some very, very hard-hitting and blunt jokes. And I suppose minor celebrity is... it's caused me to use velvet more often than previously.
Mm-hmm.
And just, you know... And I've always qualified any stuff about Brexit with, I don't know where your views lie, but, or, oh, I don't know where your views lie, but you know what, I saw your election results. Just something mm-hmm. playful that acknowledges there might be a political distance between the... If you're playful about the distance you might have with an audience, I think that's much better than just calling them twats. But you know what? It's not how I decide the material. I decide the material on whether I think it's funny.
Yeah.
And sometimes you're wrong, and you stick with it, and you stick with it, and you stick with it. But I'm kind of lucky that things, you know, none of my stories are lies. My stories are stuff that's happened to me. There's, you know, my signature routine for a bit was the story of four racists in Halifax collaring me in the street, asking me if I had a bomb in my bag. And then one of them said, wait a second, can I get a selfie with you? And this is actually something that happened to me on the way to a gig in Halifax. Barnsley, sorry, not Halifax, Barnsley. There's, you know, there's, what's the language guidance on this podcast?
Oh, whatever you like.
There's a story of a terrifying man at an Anthony J. Brown gig who said to me, you'd better be funny, you triple-necked packy motherfucker. And these were words he actually said to me.
Jesus.
And so real life is going to be plenty to go on. And I really enjoy, I've got no reason to totally fabricate stories from no, obviously I exaggerate. We all do. And obviously, there are anecdotes where I say things that I would never be stupid enough to say in real life. And there are anecdotes where I say things I'd never be clever enough to say in real life. We all have anecdotes of both come into those categories. But all the anecdotes are fundamentally true in essence.
When I think of the routines that I'm most, like if I were to describe one of your bits to someone, the two that spring most readily to mind are working in King's Lynn, stitching up the faces of people abusing
that's
you.
That's a long time ago.
It's a long
ago
time ago. Well, it's a good bit, you know, and, you know, long connoisseurs of your work will be familiar with the punchline to do with, you know, scars in the shape of a cock and balls on the faces of people who've been abusing you. And the other big one for me, and it was one of my favourite circuit jokes of all time, was the, do you need any help packing? And I'll just pronounce that.
My
careful pronunciation of that will let the enlightened listener imagine what was going on in that punchline. But those,
and that is something that actually happened.
Incredible.
That's where I got the joke. Is I was at a till and a woman said, "Would you like help packing?" And I nearly burst out laughing. That's actually the end of the actual anecdote.
So I'm not going to explain it any further as a reward. It's an Easter egg for people who are familiar with your earlier work. But those routines were, as we know from our first your first appearance on this podcast, they were written in inverted commas in your car whilst driving to gigs and honed over many, many club gigs.
Yes.
Do you find the environment of performing tour shows more so than club gigs to fans who are on board anyway is helping you create bits that are as big and punchy as those club-based routines, those club-honed routines?
I'll be totally frank. I've never been a better comedian than I am at the moment, honestly. I mean, I sometimes watch videos of club gigs and go, blimey, this is funny. I don't remember being this crisp. I think crisp is a good word. Crisp with the delivery of jokes. But I'm really good at the moment. I mean, I don't mean to be big-headed, but I'm just saying it out there. I got four standing ovations out of four gigs two weekends ago. I mean, it did help that I got, you know, that I ended very big.
Yeah.
In terms of what I was doing, but I think there's just don't give a fuck. More playful attitude to what I'm doing at the moment. I'm doing things artistically more whimsical than you'd expect from me. Mm-hmm. I did gigs the weekend of gigs that I did a couple of weekends ago. There was behind you were two billboards of comedians' faces that had played the gig before, and I just did this routine about. There have been comedians who played these gigs before, and some of them, when asked if they would do it for a fifth of the price, because social distancing means there's not many people in, some of them said yes, and some of them said no. And fortunately, Wayne, the promoter, has put each group on a separate poster behind my shoulder. And there was a photo of Simon Evans next to Delisa Chiponda on one of the posters. And I just said, this is South Africa's premier racial double act, Simon and Delisa. The shtick is that one's a racist and one's a black guy, and it's absolutely hilarious. And at that moment, they just looked like South Africa's premier comedy double act. And I think that's what I mean when I say I'm doing things I've not really done before. And
should we underline that you're not calling Simon Evans a racist at this point?
I'm not calling Simon Evans a racist. I'm saying that in a certain light, they look like a double act for whom that could be their shtick. But yeah, and then I got because it was an outdoor gig the other day, I got heckled by two dogs in a garden next to it, and that would have, one day that would have completely thrown me. But I was talking about the wedding at the time on stage, and I just created this thing where these two dogs were hired by us for the wedding. They've followed me around every gig shouting homophobic abuse at me everywhere I go, and the dogs started barking at me again, and I just went, what's that? They were both faggots and one of them was Jewish. Yeah, you knew that at the time. And I'm standing on stage going, this isn't me improvising a whimsical routine,
yes,
about racist anti-Semitic dogs.
Yes, not very improvisational from what I remember.
In
the past. So that's very an interesting much, yeah, inhibition related.
And I feel that I'm in the form of my life. Things, it's not just the Parkinson's. COVID's changed things as well. And it's not so much having COVID. It's just that realisation that we've all got to have that nothing's ever going to be the same again. I mean, nothing is ever going to be the same again. Our industry, the way people look at comedy, the way people take in comedy, we have to do the best with what we've got. And the best we've got is taking chances for some time. I can't just sit around being the comedian I've been all my life. Not good enough anymore. Got to move with the times.
What do you anticipate, on COVID, or COVID, as I've been pronouncing it up till now, but you've got the qualifications.
Who knows? I know.
What are your anticipations for what will happen for comedy over the next few
years? I have no idea. I feel fortunate that, given my level of status, if people do survive, I'm going to be probably survive in terms of their career. I'm likely to be in that group because my face is deemed to sell tickets. Mm-hmm. And I already feel desperately sorry. You know, you're aware that our business was morphing and changing and evolving and devolving before COVID came along. Mm-hmm. And it'd become increasingly hard, for instance, for anyone with no TV credits to get a headlining spot at a gig, no matter how brilliant, mm-hmm, they were, mm-hmm, because they weren't necessarily deemed to sell shift tickets. We were already live stand-up comedy, I'm talking about, was already declining as the option for upwardly mobile people to spend their money.
Yeah.
Because the degree to which we're being beaten by Netflix and Just Eat has never been truly appreciated. Whenever I see an article going, why the overly woke PC police are destroying live comedy as an art form, I'm like, what are you talking about? Live comedy's changed because Mr. newly married couple who used to go and watch live comedy would much rather sit down with a bottle of Prosecco and a shish kebab takeaway from Just Eat than they would go out. Mm. Home entertainment is such an attractive and alluring thing now that we have to work harder to compete.
And what I've found it's done, and I completely agree with that. I hadn't thought about the kind of food related apps being an issue, but of course they're part of it. One of the things I've noticed, one of the pressures, is that I feel comedy is more than ever before streamed into people with TV credits, and there's a lot of TV to be on, so there's a lot of people with TV credits, like, yeah, the supply and people who aren't, the supply is so much that now, like, so there are so many comics out there that now, of course there are comics who are model good looking, of course there are comics who have,
yeah,
extraordinary work ethics, do you know what I mean, because there are simply so many, or people who are genius level intelligent. Do you know what I mean? Like, because there are so many comics, so the odds of those of us, you know, it's sort of it's not good enough anymore to come on stage and talk about your problems. You know, no matter how honest you are, because there are so many other factors at play.
I think, my third episode of my radio series next week has a joke alluding to that. There's a supermodel called Titania Patiz, who was in the famous Vogue cover in 1990 with Naomi Campbell, Christy Turlington, Linda Evangelista et al. And me and Ollie call people the Titania Patiz of something when they're the significantly least well-known of a very famous group.
Gotcha.
And I end next week's radio show. I talk about this for the whole half hour. And I say at the end, why am I discussing this for a whole half hour? Because one day I know I'm going to be the Titania Patiz of gay, Asian, former doctor, stand-up comedians with Parkinson's disease. And it's my job to tell our story. The world is evolving. There are lots of gay Asian comedians. There are a few gay doctor comedians. There's gay, me and Adam Kay went to the same school for crying out loud. Everything's covered. And it's a competitive thing. And I love it. I love stand-up comedy. It gives me such a thrill to stand on stage, and it pains me that so many people don't know, I'm going to be big-headed here, how good I am at it. It pains me to when they see me making lame jokes on The Chase, and they go, this guy's meant to be a stand-up comedian.
Yeah.
Oh, my word. I'm like, or they only know me from YouTube. Just go out and watch live comedy. It'll blow your mind. Live comedy is an art form. Blew my mind the first time I started doing it, and still continues to blow my mind when it's done well. And Edinburgh for me and Ollie is like a theme park for a month. It's just so much fun just watching show off. I mean, Ollie loves comedy more than I could ever love comedy, and he's like a scavenger. Well, I wake up in the morning and go, where, Ollie? Where? It turns out he's at the BCS rooms watching a one-man monologue on the Free Fringe about D'Artagnan or something. I don't know. I've not been to Edinburgh since 2018, and I miss it so much.
Yeah.
Because performing is necessarily the greatest thing on earth, because being a performer at Edinburgh comes with so many stresses and anxieties that calling it massively enjoyable is perhaps not the correct phrase, but watching everything is massively enjoyable, and being in Edinburgh for a month is massively enjoyable. I think other people have the luxury, other chasers are better mentally equipped and can take it lightly. But when lockdown began, also what else began was a show called Beat the Chasers, a spin-off show from The Chase. So we had Chase Repeats on in the afternoon and Beat the Chaser on in the evening. And me having COVID-19. Mm. So simultaneously, I was getting newspaper headlines about stuff that happened 4 years ago, stuff that happened in January, and stuff that happened that day. And there was, really discombobulating. It's going, which bit of this time machine are they talking about at the moment? I mean, I feel sorry for the journalists more than anything else, because they're so young and inexperienced and just told to do what they're told. But I don't think they realise that it affects people. Mm. Their bad journalism mentally affects people. When they print, I was on Dictionary Corner in Countdown, and every so often, if their maths hadn't been got, Rachel Riley would give it to me because she knew I liked maths. Mm-hmm. This was turned into Rachel accuses Paul Sinha of being after her job, when actually she'd said something like, "Oh, we'll be after my job next," or something. And that was just a little joke. And you got to go and contact Rachel Riley to just make sure to say, "Oh, that thing went away. That's not true. I'm not I'm not after your job." These things have real, real life consequences. if I'm lying in bed ill with COVID-19 and the headline is Bradley calls for Paul Sinhard to get the sack, and then you read the story and it was an episode from 2016 where I got a question wrong and Bradley says, do you know what, I should be up there, you should get the sack, as a throwaway joke, and that's now a newspaper headline four years later or whatever. These things have real life effects on people. That's what they don't seem to realise.
What I want to ask, it's to do with that level of fame. Would you be happier to have, say, half the audience size and never have to put up with that kind of shit?
No, because that would be allowing them to win. I'll take whatever life throws at me, frankly. And for every time I complain about stories in the tabloids, I remember that great night out I had in a bar in Preston or wherever, drinking with people that I really, really liked. And I go, there's lots of good sides to fame. Yeah. I'm not ungrateful. Yeah. I'm not ungrateful at all. The tabloid thing is ridiculous. And it nearly broke me in March. When I realised that I tweeted about a friend who died and that friend was now in the papers because I tweeted, it nearly totally broke me. Well, I'm now having to contact, they contacted me, his family, and said, don't worry, Paul, we know what happened. And at times it breaks you, but I wouldn't swap the good part of being famous at all. There is at my wedding in December were six guys from Birmingham. I did a gig for Spiky Mike in January 2017 in Birmingham Uni. And one of them sent me a tweet going, we've got a house party in Birmingham, do you want to come? And me and Ollie went to this house party and they were at my wedding. And Urban Dictionary has a phrase called the Sinhar Sesh based on the fact that this story of me going to this house party had made the papers. And I think to all the friends that I've made because I'm sort of famous. And I go, yeah, I wouldn't swap that for the world. Do your worst tabloids. I'm not going to let you in.
I've got two final questions for you, Paul. Both of them are things that are kind of staples of this podcast now, but they weren't back in 2012. The first is, and I would only ask this obviously of people I regard as very successful, why aren't you even more successful?
That's a really good question. I think the fact that I don't have instinctive funny bones is one. I think the fact that at a crucial stage of their careers, Ramesh and Nish showed far harder work ethic than I did. I spent too long resting on familiar material. I basically took 4 years out of doing an Edinburgh show, 2011 to 2015, because these were my first four chase years, and I was concentrating on the chase. I think that's about it.
So do you think so? That was quite a key time, I guess, in both Nish and Romesh's careers. And
yes.
Do you feel that's an accurate appraisal of the amount of seats at the table for a British Asian performance?
I feel there are more seats, but I think Nish and Romesh maybe occupy a similar territory to me.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're great, to be perfectly honest with you. But I also feel that because I've not been at a big agency, and I've never paid for PR since 2007.
Mm-hmm.
I did this year, by the way. I was going to go with one of the big ones this year. I was that confident I was going to have a good Edinburgh. I won't mention her name, but I had PR for this year. That's how seriously I was taking it. But I think that PR does make a big difference.
I feel so conflicted when newer acts or any acts contact me and say, hey, should I spend money on PR at Edinburgh? I feel so conflicted. I never know what to say. I never want to advise people to throw $2,000 plus VAT at a PR person, but I can see it make a difference to some people.
But I don't really know why I've never been asked to do Live at the Apollo, because I think my skill set's perfect for it.
Yeah, right.
But But I've never been asked to do Live with the Apollo or McIntyre. So I think the fact that a certain agency don't throw any work my way is always will always be part of the reason I'm not more famous. But I'm certainly not bitter. I've pursued my own path and luck, you know, got lucky with the chase in increasing people's awareness of me whilst doing something that I'm really good at. So that's the other thing, Stuart. I'm the British champion. No one can ever take that away from me. It's a weird set of circumstances in which it happened, but for 12 months of my life, I was the British quiz champion. It's going to come. My reign is going to come to an end in 3 weeks. But
will they? Unless you get to pull the Jordan Brooks special move, whereby they cancel the next event and you get 2 years out of it.
But I also think that people can find it very easy to label you, and often that labelling is not necessarily as nuanced as reality.
Yeah.
So to some people, I'm that gay comedian. So some people, I'm that gay Asian comedian. To some people, I'm that comedian who likes football. To some people, I'm that comedian that does Radio 4 shows. To some people, I'm that guy that's on the chase. Mm-hmm. There's very few people who realise I'm all of those things. No one seems to take in the totality. I've had a remarkable 20 years. And yet I'm still not that famous. I mean, imagine being the guy who was voted best foreign comedian at the New Zealand Comedy Festival and the guy who won the British Quiz Championships. And they both took place in the same year that you got married, that I got married, and I was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, and that I appeared as one of Taskmaster's least successful contestants. Imagine that all happened in the same year. Perhaps really ought to be more famous than I am. but I'm certainly not bitter about it.
Last question. Are you happy?
I have tantrums and always come through the tantrums. That's the answer. Am I in a happy place? Yes. Do I veer off that happy place frequently, even daily? Yes. But overall, I consider myself a happy person. Happy with my lot. Happy with my life.
Oh, bloody lovely Paul Sinner. There we are. There he is. I love spending time with him. There's some great some listener questions which were asked via the ComCom Facebook group about transferable skills from being a doctor, about loosening up your delivery of gags, about whether there was a sort of crossover from his persona as a GP and a comic, and of course some really interesting inside track stuff on Taskmaster and why he had the experience that he had. So all of that available at comedianscomedian.com/insiders, where you can join the Insiders Club and also get those fantastic ComCom writing tips from Gary Gulman. If you haven't heard Gary's episode that came out last week, please dip back into that. Plus all of the extra material from any episode that has extra material. And it is now, God, I mean, it's got to be, it's getting on for 100 hours, isn't it? Must be, probably more, loads of extra stuff. Join up if you please, and that's the way that I would encourage you to support the podcast. I do occasionally get one-off donations, but it's much better for both of us if you subscribe for a minimum £2 or as much as you want. But remember, even if you pay more, you get the same stuff. We're democratizing the extra content and not serving those of you who have more money than the others. I should probably reduce that to a soundbite, but I haven't. That's all. A little bit of. I mean, dare I call it fan mail? Yeah, someone, a guy called Luke, a comic called Luke, got in touch and said this. I'll tell you what, let's cover this in the postamble. I'll talk to you in the postamble is the bit at the end of this podcast where I kind of talk to you a bit more about my life, because I like to stay relatively quiet during the actual show and let the guests speak for themselves. So let's consider that the guest has now spoken for himself. And I hope you will catch up with Paul. He's quizzing all over the place on Zoom, and you can see him pop up all over the internet and indeed on telly. So please do that. But stick around for the postamble in just a second. I will speak to you next week. Look after yourself. So, yeah, here we go. This is Luke.
Luke says, listening to the first podcast back after the break, that was the Larry Dean episode a few weeks ago, I noticed that I'd lapsed in my consideration of mental health issues for the last few months. It's mainly because of after a few months of stress, all of my shows on cruise ships being cancelled and worrying about the future, will I ever get to do that cruise show again? My partner and I got ourselves sorted out into a new normal with new plans for the future. Well done, Luke. I've not really been exposed to other people struggling with depression or mental health issues, and while that was talked about a lot in general early on in the COVID lockdown times, it has fallen away a lot now. But the sign-off at the end of your podcast meant a lot to me. I hadn't noticed that the ComCom pod was a regular reminder that, hey, you might be doing okay, but keep in mind there are lots of people who might not be. It might be weird that I need this reminder, but it was only when the podcast was on hiatus and then returned that I noticed it so clearly. So thanks, and I hope your therapy goes well, even if you can't talk about it on the pod. I'm a cool guy, etc. That's the code, if you remember. I'm a cool guy means you'll forgive me if I just get back to you with a single line, because otherwise my anxiety makes me reply to every single email in as much depth as I have time for, and I often have no time for it. But anyway, thank you for being cool, Luke. And thanks for that. I appreciate it. It is increasingly my mission statement to remind everyone to be kinder to themselves and to each other. It'd be nice if that could be boiled down into an original and unique sounding soundbite, but I haven't got round to it because I only ever really think in this mode. My God. Okay, let's deal with this in sections. I'm sorry to hear your cruise ship gigs were cancelled, and who knows when they will return. I know that must be scary. And that's a particular, I suppose, you know, no one's out there banging a drum for, hey, what about the cruise performers? But come on, they're entertainment professionals who specialise just like any of us. You know, it's just so hard, isn't it? I suppose because of the nature of the stuff I'm doing online, I'm frequently in touch with comics who are, I suppose, well diversified in their output, because the nature of me getting them to do stuff online with me means that they're doing stuff online. But I absolutely am aware that a lot of comics really rely on big live experiences. And, you know, I mean, I see the Abandomans, the people who've... the Abandomans, I've just made Rob Broderick sound like he's a band. Abandoman, a.k.a. Rob Broderick, friend of the show. He's doing incredible stuff. He's got a Twitch channel, just been made partner, and is doing Instagram lives all the time, and has done the most... He's just self-taught, sumptuous visuals, an incredible kind of technical pop-ups. He's just completely taught himself how to kill online. Not all of us have got... obviously, he's a freestyle rapper, so there's that kind of like twin-pronged, wonderful kind of profusion of stuff. A profusion of stuff. Thinks autobiography title. But not everyone is in that position. Not everyone has the space in their life to relearn and pivot and diversify. You know, people have got multiple children. Imagine, there's a thing, not just children, multiple children. You know, people have very specific live acts that can't work online. And people, are, and of course, the cruise performers and other people who've kind of specialised in very specific ways of performing, which are on hiatus, perhaps for a long time, if not ever. So... I don't know, what am I reminding you of? I'm just saying, let's remember that we're all in different boats. That's it. COVID, we're all in different boats. Never has that been truer, I suppose. I always think that very hard, trying to write jokes about the experience of the pandemic, because it really highlights how different everyone's experience is. If you're a single parent in a tower block with no garden, your lockdown was wildly different to a lot of people's. And I think we should just keep trying to exercise empathy in as much as that's possible. If it's not possible, don't bother. But thank you for getting in touch, Luke. Thank you. I appreciate your words and your kind donation to the pod as well. So what to say? I mean, I've sent another email to another therapist who, again, has not got back to me as quickly as I would hope. Maybe it's better if your therapist doesn't get back to a sort of introductory, your potential therapist is too busy with work to get back to an expression of interest email. Maybe that means they're good. Maybe it'd be bad if they replied immediately. I caught myself replying to a piece of podcast listener email, don't say fan mail, far too quickly recently, and stopped myself. I happened to be doing some admin and it pinged up and I started replying. And I was like, you look really desperate, Stu. So I inserted a little fake pause there. Maybe that was you if you've been in touch recently.
I suppose, yes. So I've started looking for a new person. They haven't got back to me. What else is going on in the world? Scary hospital trip with the boy. Not COVID related, asthma related. Happens every year at this time. Dealt with. Very organised. Packed far too much stuff into three bags before going, thinking last time it was 36 hours and an overnight stay. This time, very quick. Thank you to everyone at Hozzy. And I won't identify the Hozzy, but obviously, you know, all Hozzies. Thanks to everyone at all Hozzies. Apologies for continuing to say Hozzy, but I will keep doing that. It's barely an apology, is it? I tell you what. Here's some heartbreaking homework for you. And not just heartbreaking, very funny as well. Laurie Kilmartin is my guest on the podcast an hour and a half ago, which didn't happen because I fucked up which coast she was on, and we've had to hastily reschedule because it was 5 in the morning where she is, and not 8 in the morning as I had thought. Even that, bit of an early start, but hey, she's a working mum. So she's like, 8 a.m, my kids start Zoom school, I'm there. That is now happening in a couple of hours. But before that episode comes out, and it'll be a while, we've got happily got a bit of a backlog of excellent content now. But in the meantime, go and read her Twitter feed. She's any Laurie 16, Laurie L-A-U-R-I-E, or just Google Laurie Anderson. What have I said Anderson both times? It's Kilmartin. It's Laurie Kilmartin. Why have I said Anderson? Who knows? Laurie Kilmartin is going to be on the show. Maybe I only said it once. I don't know, and I cannot, brackets, be bothered to, close brackets, check. Laurie Kilmartin is such a wonderful comic. She's a writer for Conan. She's a brilliant stand-up. If you're on Spotify or the internet, if you're on the internet, you should get on it. You can listen to 45 Jokes About My Dead Dad, which is an absolutely note-perfect, clean-as-a-whistle show, which is the sort of thing you should listen to a little five-minute section of if you are about to sit down and do some writing, because it'll just reprogram your brain on clarity. She's like a Seinfeld or an Ivana Instigator. Premise, expansion of the idea, act out, carefully selected vocabulary, just bang, 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 it's all there. It's like, oh my God, it's like the jokes are funny and also a lesson in how to write jokes. But also, very sadly, she lost her mother to COVID, and she live tweeted it because this was during big lockdown a few months ago, and she was in a position where she was with her mother via an iPad as her mother passed away. She tweeted throughout in an incredibly beautiful and very frequently funny, challengingly funny, and very heartwarming and rending kind of a way. So have a look at those. Laurie Kilmartin, she's coming up on the show. I'm recording it in a few hours and it'll be with you in a matter of weeks. That is a big recommendation. So let's leave it there for now. I've just sort of been doing that with my day. And having raised that, any other administrative efforts I've been banging on about now seem like piffle in comparison. As well they should. But your own concerns and your own mental health and your own ability or inability to get a load of things done and make yourself feel good is not piffle. So don't think I'm writing it off. I made the mistake of reading below the line on some YouTube video or other of mine, and someone commented that I was really cringe, and I don't mind at all because I'm really cringe. But I have kept thinking of it. It's months ago I said, oh, even longer maybe. But for some reason it's been in my head recently because I was just thinking, I'm kind of quite cringe, aren't I? I don't care. And then I self-righteously thought, well, if cringe means you care about people, then cringe I may be. But let's be honest, that's not what it means, is it? I've never been so unhurt by so accurate a slam. There we go. Should we leave that in? Let's leave it in. I just, for some reason, it's maybe I'm thinking of it more and more because I'm trying to be more and more honest with things I think and say in any broadcast medium. So maybe I am being more honest, and as a result, I'm being more cringe. And even though it was only one person that said it, it did make me laugh because I just agreed with it. I thought, oh God, I am a fit, aren't I? Anyway, good times. Lovely to speak to you. I'm trying to think of a funny way to cringingly sign off. But my go-to was going to be something which now I sort of think it through is probably obsequiousness rather than cringe. So let's face it, I can't cringe on demand. Can you go to hashtag cringe on demand?
All right, that'll do us. Thank you. Thank you, Paul. This is wonderful. Thanks, everyone involved in this. Jake Crossland for the log. Nathan Wood for his superb editing skills, as ever. And big shout-outs to Nathan on an episode coming up where me and my guest spend a lot of time chatting to and addressing Nathan by name. It's going to be an editing nightmare for him. And I insist he leaves almost all of it in, but not all of it, and hence the nightmare. The music was by Rob Smouten, podcast consultant. Remains Peter Dobbing, whether he likes it or not. And you can get in touch at ComComPod. Follow Paul Sinner at Paul Sinner, or go to paulsinner.com, and you can go to comedianscomedian.com, or infinitesofa.com, or childlaborpod.com, or twitch.tv/stewgoldsmith. Christ, I'm good. Or comedyinsights.com if you'd like to hear me speak to your business about resilience or authenticity. I've been smashing those lately. They've been fun. So really what we've learnt now is that I desperately need one website that makes sense and is easy to organise for me to edit from the back end, and yet does not, I'm looking at you, Google Sites, insist on putting a shit generic preview whenever anyone mentions it on social media. Blech. Right, that'll do.